Mr. Chairman and my friends, I'm supposed to talk about dissenters and their value in America and everywhere else in the world, and they do have a value. Dissent has always been the growing point of society. You never have change until someone begins to dissent from the old ways. But it doesn't necessarily follow that dissent per se is a virtue, or that every dissenter blesses mankind. It is the nature of the dissent and the quality of the dissenter which have to be considered. But the right of dissent is fundamental, and you can have no democracy without the right of dissent. Anything else, no matter how often you vote, is less than democracy because it's merely a recording of opinions that have been dictated from outside without the permission of antagonistic or opposite views. This most Americans in their calmer moments would admit. It's hard to get most Americans to admit it always in practice. And we have had in my rather long lifetime various series of and degrees of persecution of dissent. The persecution of dissent, as perhaps some of you are old enough to remember, in the First World War and immediately after was very high indeed. And this rather ironically under a liberal president, Woodrow Wilson, who in practice did not carry out the things I used to hear him say when he was a professor in Princeton. This abated, and then we began to have the great persecution of dissent, if dissent was communist. And at that time, there was some reason for it that men could advance. I didn't think it was well advanced. The idea was that communists do it to us, so we do it to them first. And there's no question that communism, and this is why I've never been a communist, communism advances a doctrine of the totalitarian control of the state or of the Communist Party on the way to their paradise, which is one of the most extreme in history. And I think you have to, by doing in advance something, some of the things that you think they would do to us if they got power. And I do not think, therefore, that our excitement about communism was entirely justified by the conditions of communism or as a means of combating the conditions that are wrong in communism. What I mean to say is this. We have adopted in connection with communism, most of us, a doctrine quite similar to the fundamentalist religious doctrine of the devil. Holy evil, something to be feared and hated, not to be analyzed and not to be understood, only to be hated, only to be crushed, if possible, by military means, if necessary, by denial of civil liberties, where possible. This has been too much the American attitude. And it hardly explains, I may say, the rise of communism and its extension. It hardly explains the fact that, for instance, communism has done as well as it has in building up Russia, crushed after the First World War, suffering terribly after the Second World War. How has it done so much in building up China? For the fact of the matter is that China is now in a stronger position than it has ever been. I am not a communist, but I ask you to think of these things and to know you do not think of them in terms simply of absolute opposition or in terms of suppressing communism simply by physical force. It's not going to be able to be done, for one thing. So we have been through a period, and it comes and goes, it's been revived somewhat, in which the denials of civil liberty or the right of dissent were largely based on fear of communism. And fear of communism, communism was proved rather ridiculously by association, guilt by association and other ideas. Now, this period reached a new climax under the administrations of Senator Joe McCarthy of Wisconsin. And you are, all of you, old enough to remember that period in our lives. It's not a very handsome period. It was ended, and Senator McCarthy was quite largely disgraced, or, if you don't like the word disgraced, was largely dismissed from his position and from his influence by the work of the Senate committee, by the inquiry, by the work of Mr. Welch, the Boston lawyer, in the case. And now we've come under a position where, in my judgment, and I have a long life to look back on, civil liberties are better protected by the courts and better protected on the whole by the government than at any time that I know of. And this is a very interesting fact that this should be so, because it is not so because the people are so much better than they are. Chief Justice Earl Warren once remarked that he doubted if the Bill of Rights of the Federal Constitution would pass a plebiscite in the United States. And I have come to a time, which I never thought I would see, when in general, in America, until about now, I regard the worst enemies of civil rights people. People in their towns and communities where they live. Not all the people, but a considerable minority of people who in one way or another seem to be organized so as to persecute dissenters privately, even although the government takes no action against them legally. This is a paradox, and a very unhappy paradox for those of us who like to believe that the people usually choose to do what is right. It has not been conspicuously true in this area. Let me show you what I mean. 1964 was an interesting presidential campaign. There were genuine differences between the candidates, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Goldwater. They weren't very well discussed during the campaign. They were well enough discussed, and the people's confidence was such that Johnson got a very large majority for a lot of reasons, partly because of his stand on social legislation, partly, I think, because his better stand on civil rights and civil liberties, partly because he was supposed to be bet more for peace than Mr. Goldwater. Whether that was true or not is not so certain. But anyway, he got this tremendous majority. But in the campaign itself, and I was in many states during that campaign, there was more persecution going on of individuals and communities by other individuals than I can remember, even in the days when socialism was a worse word than it is now, and I ran myself. Bomb threats in America are now a dime a dozen. It is said, I think correctly, I've had it verified in both New York and California, that Nelson Rockefeller, in his campaign for the presidential nomination, received more than 100 bomb threats in California. He was not blown up, but you know that there have been uses of the bomb that are very ominous in the United States of America. It is now an organized business in many parts of the country to turn on a persecution of a dissenter. A man says something you don't like or think is wrong. You then get somebody to cooperate with you, and you wake him and his family up at 1 or 2 in the morning, night after night after night. I'm thinking of specific instances. I'm not making this up at all. I know one instance where a professor, a man of high personal character, very high standing in his university, he's been persecuted systematically for saying or writing a rather extreme statement to emphasize a point which he believed. He's had a hearse sent in front of his house. His wife has at least once had his obituary mailed to her. The awakening of the family at 1 or 2 a.m. became a common way of life. Now, this has happened more or less in a great many parts of the United States. So I am here in the rather sorry position of saying that today the chief trouble for dissenters in the field of civil rights is not at the moment government, although I shall criticize government in a minute. It's not at the moment government, it's people themselves. And it's a failure somehow of the glorious American idea embodied in the first Bill of Rights of the Constitution. The failure of that to reach into the hearts and minds of people themselves. And that's why it's so important that you have meetings like this and churches and other agencies really turn to a consideration of what civil rights require. We have just had an election in the East, which is quite significant. Governor Hughes of New Jersey, not, I think, the greatest governor in the world, has been very triumphantly reelected. He's a Democrat, and with him he carried for the first time a Democratic legislature in New Jersey. One of the issues that his Republican opponent tried to exploit, as some of you must know, was this. A professor in Rutgers had said that he would like to see a Viet Cong victory. He later explained he didn't mean a military victory, but anyway, he said that. The Republican candidate for governor tried to make this the main issue of the campaign. The failure of the Rutgers University to discharge this particular professor. Governor Hughes supported the professor. Not that he agreed with him. He did not agree with him at all. But he held that there was such a thing as right, as academic liberty. There was such a thing as a constitution and loyalty to the First Amendment. Straw polls in New Jersey showed that the majority of people seemed to support the Republican criticism of this action rather than the governor. Yet when it came actually to vote and they added everything up, the governor, who was thus attacked, got a tremendous majority, which makes me think that we needn't have suffered as long as we did from Joe McCarthy if more people had had the kind of courage that Governor Hughes showed in this respect. This emphasizes this curious paradox, very real in my long experience, of, at least at the time being, higher standards by the government and legal authorities in respect to civil liberties and civil rights than the people at large. I said civil liberties and civil rights. The standard of our laws now governing civil rights is very high. It is higher than the average standard of public opinion in carrying them out, wouldn't you say so? And doesn't this concern us? It's all very well to be a dissenter, but good dissenters want to dissent for the purpose of making things different and better. They don't want to dissent just for the pleasure of dissent, of being different, of being kind of queer. That may amuse some people, but it isn't really a very notable ambition. The dissenter wants to prevail in terms of persuasion for his ideas. And he ought to be allowed a chance to do it without suffering more or less of a degree of martyrdom if we're to live up to our loyalty as believers in the democratic process. And this is particularly true in America. And I repeat once more, we have a better record at the moment in most of our judicial opinions and in most of our official actions than we have in respect to the way neighbors treat neighbors on the subject both of civil rights and civil liberties, which are closely joined. It is not the law in the state from which I come, New York, which is at fault. It's what people do in the matter of living next Negroes or having Negroes live next them. It's what people do about schools. It's what people do about employment. Not law, but people. And those of us who have dissented against the doctrine of white supremacy and have won a notable victory, and the Negroes especially who have won so much of their own revolution, have to remember that the work now that has to be done is within our own hearts and within our own communities far more than it is at the moment with government. I keep saying at the moment because I have seen government change. I'm not sure now how the government is going to change. I was one of those who publicly said that we were very disappointed that the federal government again took up the prosecution of the Communist Party for not registering. By a law known as the McCarran Act, the Communist Party was ordered to register as a subversive agency loyal to Russia. It refused. It was subject to penalties if it registered, very severe penalties for being such an organization, and was subject to very severe penalties for not registering. In other words, it was your damned either way. And at first, the first trial, the government lost because there was no one who freely testified to the fact that the communists were a subversive agency in their opinion or that they ought to register. Now they found someone to do it, and the case is going on now. A good many of us interested in civil liberties, Roger Baldwin, Grenville Clark, who's no socialist, I assure you, and a number of others whose names you might know, have protested this new prosecution. We think the law unjust. We think it's self-defeating. We do not believe you lick communism by emulating it insofar as this law does. President Truman wrote a very fine veto message which the Congress overrode when the law was passed. Now, I hope this does not signify a turn for the worse in the federal government's attitude. For a long time, it did not bring up the communist case again. Now it has brought it up, and it's before a court in Washington. It'll probably go again to the Supreme Court. And it's worth watching, for it is a law opposed to democracy. They do not punish acts. They punish a party and members of a party allegedly for their ideas and allegedly for their allegiances, not asking any evidence of any crime committed thereby. And when you ask that kind of thing, you are interfering very much with freedom of thought and freedom of expression and freedom of association. And the principle, which now is applied rather particularly at the Communist Party, can easily be stretched in time of excitement to other groups and make way for a very complete denial of the right to know, to utter, to argue freely according to conscience, the right to speak, to write, and to associate as you will. This needs some watching. It has got very little attention, as far as I know, from the paper, or a modicum of attention from the radio or television audience. But the great test now of dissent and the right dissent comes, of course, in connection with the war in Vietnam, which is so much a fact of our lives at present. And I shall speak rather disproportionately from a philosophical attitude on that. The immediate relation to the right to dissent, of course, has to do with the conscientious objection. The state, by grace, not by right, has seen fit, and to its credit, the state has seen fit to grant certain immunity to conscientious objectors to all wars. It does not extend that immunity or that chance for alternative service to objectors to particular wars, and for practical reasons, I can see why it does not. Now the question is, what bearing has the right of civil liberty, what bearing has it to conscription? And I was surprised to find that my friends of the ACLU a while back were seriously considering a resolution which said that there was no relation between civil liberty and conscription. Philosophically, I can think of no greater error than that. The greatest power of the state is exercised when the state takes a young man and forces him to fight in a war in which he may not believe, about which he may know nothing. This is not a question of the state saying, thou shalt not, it's saying, thou shalt. The state, in effect, the absolute, the military state says, thou shalt not kill retail, but thou shalt kill wholesale at my command, or else be punished. Now, you may think that the state has to say it, but you have no right to say that the state, in saying it, is considering civil liberty. And one of the perplexing and paradoxical things in the United States of America at present is the number of people I know, and you know, and probably some of them in this audience, which is a representative audience, I hope, who would say, no, there's no connection between conscription and civil liberty. Well, why not? Can you name any one thing that the supposedly over-centralized state, to quote certain people, does which is parallel to its taking a young man and saying, you must fight, you must kill in something in which you do not believe? It is the supreme denial of civil liberties. You have my friend Mr. Buckley, who made a rather interesting run for mayor in New York, very bitter and sarcastic about the overpowerful state. He's an absolute believer in conscription and in making these cowards fight. How do you reconcile that kind of thinking if you really believe in civil liberties? What you have to say, I think, is, all right, I believe in civil liberties, but it's a wicked world and we can't afford civil liberties here. The interests of humanity, the interests of the state require that we have conscription. Say that and I'll argue that issue, but don't say that it's consistent philosophically with civil liberties because it isn't. What I am saying, therefore, is that you want to be very careful before you condemn boys for burning draft cards. You may or may not think that's a sort of a show-off way to do, but I assure you that it takes a good deal of courage to face the obloquy and criticism of your own people when you do that. And short of burning draft cards, there are ways of, if you are a conscientious objector, of saying it. And there are ways, if you're a conscientious objector to this particular war, to say it and take the consequences. And it ought to be recognized that this falls most emphatically in the realm of dissent. A great many people I know say, and I say think quite justly, that the Germans committed a great crime because they never really protested against Hitler's orders, because they believed Hitler's orders. Eichmann's defense for his horrible crimes was that he's simply obeying the state in time of war. Now, don't want anyone to go out and say Thomas compares our situation to the situation in Germany. I don't. That was much worse. But in principle and in philosophy, it's very hard to say that the Germans ought to have disobeyed the state when the state commanded the cruel things it did during a war, but that Americans ought to obey the state even if their conscience leads them to believe that what they're commanded to do or to help to do is, in their judgment, a crime against humanity. This is what I want you to think about. There is a parallel there, philosophically, which is very much pertinent and very much to the point. Now, this issue is raised mostly in the world by the presence of war. And the great problem of our time, your time, for you will live lots longer than I now, is going to be to get rid of war. You see, it's one of the oldest of human institutions. Probably only some form of the family is older. As soon as there were enough people, they began to fight. Divided by clans, divided by tribes, divided by nation states, divided by imperial organizations. They began to fight. They fought originally for simple things like better land for hunting, better land for agriculture, for grazing, better land for minerals, more slaves, and then more sophisticated types of profit. They fought. Men slowly built up something called law in the internal life of their communities. At first, justice was a matter of family revenge. Blood feuds were common in the name of justice. But slowly we got law, not perfect, but law that was a great deal better than feuds. Law began inside the community to take the place of violence in the settling of disputes. There has never been a parallel growth of anything like the same magnitude in the relation of anarchic nations to one another. We have made some beginning now with the UN, and thank God we made some beginning. But by and large, we have not done anything in the field of the relation of nations to nations parallel to what we did in the relation of families and individuals to one another in the domestic community. And we've got to do it fast, because our scientists and technologists have so greatly changed the possibilities of war. It was always a cruel thing, even when employed in a more or less just cause. Now, it can be utterly destructive. We have the means at our hands already of destroying the population of the world many times over. I do not think we shall do it even in the next big war, but we shall come fairly close. Hermann Kahn has devised various stages in the process of escalation to total destruction, even if you use nuclear weapons. But you have a new possibility, and you have no longer the fact that there will be survivors in a war, and that in surviving, they may be in a better position than they were before to get some sort of justice. Not in the ruin of the world that a thermonuclear war would create, even if they're survivors. You've got to accept that fact, whether you like it or not, and you've got to work with an intelligence and an imagination for alternatives to war, such as we have not yet shown. There are beginnings, but not at all adequate beginnings. Briefly, therefore, my greatest concern, I have others, but my greatest concern is that we should progress on the road to a reasonably secure peace. And that requires, I'm going to be dogmatic for a little, that requires universal disarmament, I emphasize universal, down to a police level for preserving order in states and within states. That is to say, it's too dangerous to trust us partially irrational people and our rulers. With our passions, our love of power and all, it's too dangerous to trust ourselves with the instruments we have. I sometimes think that I'm looking at a kindergarten where there's some rather unruly boys, and the teacher decides that Jimmy and Johnny might treat each other better if each had a revolver. And so she gives them each a revolver and says, "You're only to use this for deterrence." You know what would happen. And we aren't much more advanced than that in the relation of nations to nations. We've got to have disarmament, but I do not think we will either get disarmament or keep it as a sole fact. It has to be under control. You have to have a strengthening of the UN and its institutions so that they can provide in increasing degree law, not war. This is of the utmost importance. You also have to have a much better cooperation than we have yet worked out, in spite of some of the good things we have done, with the emerging nations, with the nations whose standard of living is so pathetically low. You and I live in a very prosperous America now, even though we have our serious problem of poverty, but in a very affluent country. It's unique in the world. But we in Western Europe, and now the Soviet Union, constitute pretty much the 30% of the world, which really has reasonable assurance against hunger close to starvation. The common estimate is that 70% of the people of the world live on a narrow borderline between hunger and starvation. We've got to work out better cooperative aids to build up these people and to help them conquer this type of poverty and illiteracy. It's an enormous job. These things have to be done. But these things aren't going to be done, or not done satisfactorily, if we insist that pending our working out these plans, we are God's policeman or somebody's policeman to enforce our will of what's right, and incidentally our national interest, around the world, intervening in other people's civil wars to do what we think is best. We are not wise enough, we are not strong enough. Now, this is not isolation. I want us to be more cooperative in the great business of fighting the poverty of the world. What I do not want is for us to assume this policeman's role by the devil's means of war, saying that we do it in the service of some god called democracy or the like of that. And this brings me, of course, to the immediate question of what's going on, what did go on in Santo Domingo, what is going on in Vietnam. And now because my dissent against it is the chief interest of my life at present, bear with me while I talk about it. Let's look at this war in Vietnam. I'm not discussing it now in terms of conscription or no conscription. I'm discussing it in terms of the war itself. Let me give you a little history, and you can follow me, and in your questions you challenge my facts if you think the facts are to be challenged. The first fact I want to bring out is that we have a very strange record which very largely disqualifies us from the role of disinterested neutral in helping anything in Vietnam. Why do I say it? I say it to make my history short, because the United States never did for French Indochina what it did for the possessions, the colonial possessions of England and Holland. We backed England, we prodded Holland in order to get independence for India and Burma and Indonesia and so on. But we backed the French against any independence. The first people I ever saw from Vietnam were here shortly after the Second World War, and they said all they wanted was help and independence. So far from getting it, we helped the French, and we paid between 70 and 80% of the entire pecuniary cost of the French War to hold these people in colonial status. The French paid terribly in life, but we paid, but one authority says $2 and 3/10 billion, another says $2 and 6/10 billion, in order to help the French hold Indochina. Finally, the French decided they couldn't do it. The war had to stop. And they called a conference at Geneva, at which was worked out a scheme under which Indochina, divided into three nations, was given independence, supposedly neutralized. One of the biggest of the three nations was Vietnam, and that was divided along military lines into North and South Vietnam. And the theory was, not too plainly decreed, but decreed, that there should be a plebiscite in 56, which was 2 years after the Geneva Agreement, on which the people would decide what they wanted. Well, John Foster Dulles attended and had representatives of the United States attend the conference at Geneva, but we never signed the agreement. We merely said that we would not use force or threat of force to upset it. For a while, things went along not too badly. Very soon, Diem came to power with our aid, pretty much, and for a while seemed to do fairly well. But by and by, he became too partisan to his own family. He got involved in a miserable religious controversy between Catholics and Buddhists, a kind of controversy that had never before come to arms in Asia. He got involved in that kind of a controversy, and he stopped all economic reform. He became terribly unpopular. The United States backed his removal. But before that happened, DM had asked us to come and help him because he was facing a civil war. It was unquestionably a civil war in its beginning. It had communist influence, of course, and communist approval from North Vietnam. But it was essentially a civil war, and it did not break out until Diem had refused to hold the plebiscite of 1956, a plebiscite which we backed him in refusing. There may have been arguments for it, but it was a stipulated plebiscite. And General Eisenhower, in his memoirs, makes the astonishing statement that 80%, he thinks, of the Vietnamese people would have voted for unity, which meant unity under Ho Chi Minh. This surprises me because there had been about 1 million refugees from North Vietnam into South Vietnam. But Eisenhower, who's no socialist, let me say, is responsible for that 80% figure. Well, what was a civil war when we came in? We intervened. We intervened at least as soon and much more substantially than North Vietnam was able to. It's only been recently that the war is so much also a war of North Vietnam. And North Vietnam and the Viet Cong haven't always been on perfect terms. And North Vietnam has, so well-informed people have repeatedly said, been ready to negotiate 2 or 3 times in the past. Actually, the latest word that I have had to this effect is the following. During the suspension of bombing of North Vietnam, a Frenchman who was rather close to the North Vietnamese, living in Paris, took from the North Vietnamese legation in Paris a message to the French government to tell the American government that they would not insist on the withdrawal of all American troops before negotiating. This had been the chief obstacle to negotiation because the president's terms, as stated by Senator Mansfield in the Senate, and the North Vietnamese demands were within negotiating range once you got rid of the problem of the demand for an immediate withdrawal of American troops. Now these American troops were there and were being increased in number, but the bombing had stopped. The day after this proposal was made, the bombings began again. I doubt if the formal proposal ever reached Washington, but the news of it did. Even Ambassador Goldberg admitted to me that the news of this reached Washington, but there were other considerations, he said. In other words, there is a good deal of evidence that at various times North Vietnam would have negotiated, probably Viet Cong gone along with it. I want you to remember that because of what I'm going to say hereafter. What I'm saying now is the first fact about this war is that we were in a bad position to play the disinterested friend because we had so conspicuously backed the French and because we had not signed the Geneva Agreement. The second thing is that I want to say is that while we were truly invited by Diem, we were invited into what was primarily a civil war at the time. This I need to emphasize because it's contrary to the official position of the government, which regards it primarily as a war of aggression from the North. That is not established. And I have been carefully over the evidence. The next thing I want to establish as a fact is what I don't think you will want to quarrel with, and that is that whatever we're defending in South Vietnam, it is not liberty, unless you equate liberty simply with anti-communism. The man who asked us in, Diem, was deposed with our consent, murdered, I think, without our consent. There's been a succession, 8, 9, 10 different military dictators, all of them rather weak. Government's corrupt. They are providing no liberty at all. The information is practically uncontradicted on the miserable type of government that the Vietnamese, our Vietnamese allies are furnishing at the present time. It is a simple fact that there are more North Vietnamese students who try to dodge the draft than there are defectors from Viet Cong, and we advertise defectors from Viet Cong. This is just a fact. We have encouraged a situation in which religious war has grown to a point where a recent writer, Jack Long Coots in the New York Times, after being there a year, says that a great many people care more about the religious war than they do about the war on Viet Cong. Vietnam, which was a reasonably comfortable country and rice exporting country, is now desperately poor. It has to import food, and we take considerable credit to ourselves that we are trying to feed them and that we're trying to help them as long as they're good and where we can get at them. This is what's happening in Vietnam. And to say that we're protecting freedom, except in the narrow sense of anti-communism, is almost nauseatingly absurd in view of the historical record. The next fact that I think you have to consider is that we have, that the war itself, as we're now carrying it on, is a peculiarly cruel war. Not because Mr. Johnson wants it so, or anybody else, I suppose. It's peculiarly cruel because of the way it's fought. In the first place, it's a guerrilla war. And guerrilla warfare, one of its principles, requires some use of terrorism, and there's no doubt Viet Cong has used it. Used it pretty extensively. So extensively that you would think that they'd be hated by the people. But apparently, it is, in spite of terrorism, less hated than you would think, or otherwise it would not have spread as well as it has in the country. Now, we, in dealing with Viet Cong, are very embarrassed. The same man will be your friend, apparently, in the daytime and your enemy at night and all the rest of it. And we have taken to the use of bombing very extensively as a means of prevailing. Now, we say that we are bombing only strategic points in North Vietnam and South Vietnam. We say we're only trying to bomb facilities or installations used by the Viet Cong or aggregations of Viet Cong-East soldiers. And it's true lately, not until lately, that we've tried to give some warning where we're going to bomb a village. It's also true that we tried to take care of civilian victims of bombing. It's also true that there's one clear case of utterly mistaken bombing in which we destroyed a village because of the wrong information. It's also true that these strategic points in North Vietnam that we are bombing all have people living around them. And there was, a week or so ago, in the New York Times magazine, another non-socialist paper, this very impressive article by this Jack Longgoose, who talks about what this bombing means in North Vietnam, the number of villagers who are killed, but the desperate earnestness of the people still to continue the fighting. They're not deferred, not dismayed. He says that if we succeed in destroying some of the bombs, some of the dams we've aimed at, we'd destroy a whole countryside by the floods we'd induce. It would be genocide. Some of you may have seen a picture briefly shown on one of the TV screens. It showed American paratroopers, brave men, of course, dropped on the edge of a paddy field and also the edge of the jungle, the elephant grass jungle. These boys at once advance in something like military formation through the paddy field, destroying, of course, whatever rice there was, looking down foxholes, which were numerous, firing into foxholes. They killed a woman who had taken refuge there. Advancing toward the village, there was a very feeble counter fire. This is on the screen. They got five or six Viet Congese and lined them up, took them prisoner. And then you saw them apply a torch to the village. These were American soldiers doing it because that's the only way you can fight this kind of a war. This same New York Times writer says that we can win the war, provided the Chinese don't come all the way in, or the Russians. We can win the war. But to do it, he thinks we'll have to kill two Vietnamese for every Viet Conger. There is no other way at all. This is a cruel war of the most horrible sort that we're forcing our own boys to fight. Furthermore, in the New York Herald Tribune, which is another non-communist paper, I just want to be sure of my authorities, it is Republican. Well, anyway, a writer named Jimmy Breslin, who is in Vietnam, described how our Chinese allies, nationalist Chinese, Chang people, took prisoners and kept them from escaping. They fastened their hands, their cheeks, this way. Naturally, they can't make much trouble when they're wired up that way. But it's a horrible thing to do. I wrote to the Defense Department about it, and after a long delay, only the other day, got an answer, practically admitting that this was done. But it explained that these were some Chinese that happened to be living there, and we couldn't manage them very well, and that anyway, look at all the Viet Cong atrocities. I say that I had thought we had come to a stage where we had at least some inkling of a belief that you overcame evil with good, and that you did not think you were going to win against communism by practicing, by the nature of the war, a more deadly destruction of civilians than they do, even by their atrocities, which have to be personal. This is the situation. And what profoundly affects me is to speak to audiences who seem to be so indifferent to the inherent cruelty, to the cruelty that we are forcing our boys to be part of. Oh, there are many of them flying and hardly see it. But they are doing this. What would we say if it was some other country? Oh, well, you say, we have to do it. It'd be worse if the communists should win. Well, do you really think we're going to stop the communists from winning this way? I don't. I think we are making communists all over the world. And I have contacts which make me speak with some authority. The more dynamic parts of the population in Asia and Africa are all against us on this ground. They are getting a sympathy with communism that they might not otherwise get. Communism has its faults. Communism has its failures. Many people are blind to it because of this white imperialist aggression, as it is called, our war in Vietnam, for it is our war today, though it's undeclared completely. This is a plain fact. You are told that if only we would stand firm, Asia would be quiet. Well, we've been standing firm, and look, is Asia quiet? There is a communist revolt of some sort even in Indonesia. Our allies have been fighting each other with arms we gave them, India and Pakistan. Malaysia had the secession of Singapore. What we are doing is not stabilizing Asia. What we are doing is to raise doubts of ourselves, of our leadership of democracy. It's giving the communists something to talk about beside their own failures. And this is a very serious fact. Well, you say, anyway, maybe now, but we'll win. Will we, without escalating the war? There are war hawks that want us to escalate the war or want the war to escalate until China comes in and we'll have an excuse to destroy China's military power, of course, by nuclear bombs. There is no other way. We might do that at great cost to ourselves and to the world. But afterwards, what? Do you think for a minute that by destroying China's military power, we'll solve the communist or the Chinese question? A nation of some 700 million people living where they do in Asia, far from us, a very capable people, a nation which under communism has got better conditions than it had before. However much you may object to some things communists have done, there's no question that this is true. It's more powerful than ever before. Do you think that a military victory could be permanent? Are we going to station soldiers forever in Southeast Asia? Are we forever to be willing to bomb it? Don't we know that there is no power that will permit our children or grandchildren to prevail indefinitely if we think in military terms? Don't you know that whether you like it or not, you've got to find a way of coexisting with the Chinese? It's going to be hard, and it's much harder than it would have been if we'd adopted a different policy. You say we can't coexist. Well, Protestants and Catholics thought that and fought a very cruel 30 years war about it back in the 17th century. They found out that in time they could coexist and even coexist on pretty good terms. We've got to find it out, letting evolution do the work, letting the power of democracy's example, our achievements in dealing with civil rights under democracy, our achievements in conquering poverty under democracy speak for us much louder than they do now. I am not saying that I want us to yield to communism, but I'm saying that you are never going to defeat communism by the kind of war effort that we are now engaged in and may go on into, and that we have been wrong from the beginning in our Chinese policy in insisting that we would not recognize the fact that the communist government ruled China more efficiently than she'd ever been ruled for centuries. We insisted that Taiwan, the Chong'an Taiwan, who has never let the Taiwanese vote, by the way, that Chong represents China. He does nothing of the sort. He represents mostly the 7th American Fleet. And almost everyone knows that fact. And we are flying in the face of fact and in the face of common sense in our Chinese policy. I know that it's difficult now to negotiate, but we ought even now to negotiate with China in terms of bringing China into the family of nations. It's the only alternative to a war that I may not live to see, but some of you almost certainly will, and a most disastrous war. We've got to bring her in. And that requires a very different approach than we have had. An approach more nearly like ours to Russia, which has moderated very greatly being in the UN than if she'd been left out the way China was left, has been left out so far. This I insist on. Yes, we have to say to China, you'll have to make a real peace in Korea. You'll have to acknowledge that your border conflict with India must be arbitrated, not fought out. This sort of thing we have a right to say. And we may not get a favorable answer, but we've got to show the world that we stand for an inclusion of this fifth of mankind in any effort to get world peace, and that we do not insist on the monstrous, ridiculous folly of saying that a discredited, old, weak dictator, Chiang, driven out these dozen or more years ago, represents her in the UN. It simply isn't true, and we have to learn it, painful as it is. Everything is rather painful. We couldn't have made the mistakes that mankind, and we among mankind, have made without paying something for it. But even now, the best thing to do is to get a negotiated peace. Johnson has said it. And many of the criticisms that I hear of my proposals are really applied to Johnson's negotiated peace. Under Nixon and others, there's growing a no-negotiation attitude or an unconditional surrender attitude, which simply means an everlasting prolongation of war with perhaps breaks in it. It simply is the road to ultimate destruction. You have to coexist without war, or you will not exist indefinitely. Now, Mr. Johnson's proposals are pretty decent, except that he doesn't propose the conditions which would make a proud enemy negotiate. He has insisted originally so far that he wouldn't even have Viet Cong at the negotiating table. Now he says they can come in as sort of annexes to North Vietnam, which is a good deal like George III of England, you've heard of him, saying to Louis XVI of France at the time of our revolution, let us negotiate, but don't let that rascal George Washington come around. Because it's the Viet Cong that we have to face, its political arm at least, which really controls in territory the majority of the Vietnamese territory south of the boundary. We've got to recognize it, and the president ought to say it. The president ought also to make it clear that the object of negotiation is to remove all military, foreign military presences from the old Indochina, to carry out the Geneva Agreement on this point, that we have no intention of keeping permanent military guard there. And then he ought himself, rather dramatically, to initiate the demand for ceasefire. Mr. Johnson has done rather wonderful things in civil rights. He's done rather dramatic things. Look, he signed the freer immigration law in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty. And incidentally, some of our foreign enemies or friends think that that statue is what we, holding the torch is what we burn villages with, which is wrong. Well, anyway, Johnson has a sense of the dramatic. Why can't he see what a place he'd make in history? He, the president of the most powerful nation in the world, renouncing the usual rule of power politics, which is to fight for power blindly, even if in the end you lose it. This is the rule of history. Suppose Johnson said, I know this rule of history and we've got to have peace. I therefore demand a ceasefire, and in proof of my earnestness, I stop bombing. I propose that this ceasefire shall be attended by a complete prohibition of the sending of arms and men into the disputed territory. I propose that the ceasefire be supervised by the UN or by a committee of neutral powers. I propose that there be an immediate beginning of negotiations, which I've already said could be unconditioned. Negotiations that will at least reach an agreement that will give us as good a guarantee as we can get against chaos and massacre when troops are withdrawn, a negotiation that will give a chance for evolution and development, a negotiation that will give the people of Vietnam, North and South, a chance to speak on what they want as they have not done in the past. This is what we want. And with this, we can cooperate, as I've already said, in the Mekong Valley and elsewhere, for the upbuilding of this war-ravaged, war-distressed region. Suppose Johnson would say that, I think he'd get results. If he didn't, we'd have another set of facts, but I am sure that they would hardly dare refuse negotiation when it was so obviously in the interest of the people and so obviously gave them a chance to win what they could win without war if they believed that they have the right answers. Maybe ultimately the answer would be something like a Asian Yugoslavia, tied neither to Russia or China. The Vietnamese don't like the Chinese. I've been in, not there, but in Southeast Asia, and the Chinese are pretty generally unpopular with those people. And Ho Chi Minh is not just a tail to either a Russian or a Chinese kite. You could have a Yugoslavia there, a neutralized Yugoslavia, infinitely better than the continuing the war. Well, some of you will say, Mr. Thomas, you've wandered far from dissent. No, I haven't. I have said that people who are trying to say that are patriots. They are doing what they ought to do. You have to answer them not by abuse. You have to answer them by argument. It is our duty, we who feel like this, in the wisest and fairest way possible, to present this to our fellow citizens and to the government of the United States. And going beyond that, because I care so deeply, beyond the question of dissent, I am talking now about a right policy as against a wrong policy. I am talking now about the necessity of getting a policy which is fit for that, those difficult developments which we must have if we are to banish war from the world in which war has become the ultimate of destruction, thanks to our scientific progress. This we've got to do. And we begin by showing that even at this late date, and in spite of mistakes, it is possible to find a way in South Vietnam and in North Vietnam, not of perfection, that is probably impossible, but a way infinitely better than the way that compels our boys under conscription to fight so cruel a war with so dubious a possible result, as is the case now. Thank you.
Mr. Thomas is delighted to answer questions. If you have any written out, the ushers will pick them up. If you'll pass them into the middle aisles, and if you lack a pencil or card, they will be glad to provide such for you. Mr. Thomas, it's been very interesting to me, and perhaps it's because of your subject, but here you are, a notorious, or should I say notable socialist, and you haven't even mentioned economics all night. As socialism...
I'll say, for instance... That
would you move over a little to that, to the middle there for that microphone?
I'll say that the labor unions on foreign policy are to the right of the Wall Street Journal. And I'm very sorry for it. I'll admit that there is an economic interest in jobs and what can be done. But in all fairness, I do not think the primary motive in the war in South Vietnam is economic. It's subsidiary.
Would you move over to the middle of that desk so that you get that microphone? Thank you, sir. Do you believe that there's any need for a third party in America today?
Sure, there's a need for it, but how you get it is another matter. We've got a dreadfully confused situation. We've got two old parties, both of which take ideas from third parties when they need them, and purify them by taking them, you see. There isn't too much difference even now between Republicans and Democrats. You have, this, for instance, a wonderful illustration of this in New York. In the recent election, the Republicans and the conservatives, that's Buckley's party, nominated the same man for borough president of Staten Island, Richmond, and he won. The Republicans and Labor nominated the same man for borough president in Bronx, and he won. What happens to distinctions when you get such a mess as that? You need what you need is not three parties. The way we elect a president and other factors, which I can't go into, make it desirable to have two parties, mostly a two-party government. But you need a different alignment. And the purpose of third parties has been to supplant one of the others. Or it has been sometimes the purpose to reform one or the others. I'm willing to take either course. And I believe, of course, in the right of third parties to exist. So expensive is campaigning. Well, it would take a whole other lecture for me to tell you the tactical difficulties. But this, our Socialist Party, didn't believe its best use of time and strength would be to get 40 or 50,000 votes in 1964. We believed in doing what we did, work out a good platform, expounding as far as possible, leaving our members free to vote as their conscience dictated, but in general for Johnson on the ground that we were partway with LBJ because he was partway with us. Next.
Is the John Birch Society a dangerous element in our country today?
Yes. That and what it stands for is a dangerous element. I don't say that it's plotting anything. I say that its approach is contrary to the spirit of the times. And where you get the John Birch Society strong is where you get some of the worst persecution of dissenters. I do not say that the Birch Society is responsible for it directly, but I'm simply stating a fact, and I've been pretty well around the United States. Incidentally, I've debated Welch, the president of that, twice. And you know, he talks more like an anarchist than the old-fashioned anarchist. He hates government so much. He says he isn't an anarchist, and I have to believe him. But I wish you'd heard the debates. Next.
Would you advise national...
I wasn't that I was so good, he was so bad. Next.
Would you advise nationalization of transportation and steel industries today, or organize them as a public utility?
Yes, I would. I don't think it's the main issue. The main issue is public is foreign policy. But when you get an industry like steel, where the prices are administered, and there's no such thing as real control by competition, and the industry is so basic, it's better to be owned by the public and operated under one or more divided TVA organizations, that is, structure which would represent the consumers and the producers in it, not too closely tied to the political government, like Tennessee Valley Authority. I believe in that, and I believe that we're going to have to take over the public utilities, as New York City is having to do, simply to keep out of bankruptcy altogether. I'd like to point out something. It's a fashion now to say that you are for our present system because of the free enterprise it allows. Well, you're in the state which is the base of the General Motors, which is the most profitable corporation in the world. How much free enterprise does it allow in the field? You get a job, you do what the directors plan. There's none of the old-fashioned competition and strife that used to be hailed as the way to run economy. General Motors, under its type of planned economy, for the benefit of stockholders, and also, I suppose, they have to keep the workers satisfied, General Motors in this has produced a bigger revenue than any country in the world except the United States, the Soviet Union, Great Britain, and France. It had a larger revenue, larger income last year, a little bit, than West Germany, and much larger than other countries. And that's not free enterprise in the old-fashioned sense.
In the course of your lecture, Mr. Thomas, you mentioned that you were going to give an opinion on San Domingo, but you did not give it.
Well, I thought I implied it. You know, I know lots more than I had time to tell you tonight. Santo Domingo, we did exactly in Santo Domingo what we blamed the Russians for doing. The Russians intervened in Hungary in a civil war, saying, Khrushchev said it, and one of their representatives in New York told me the same thing afterwards. They didn't intervene because they were so much opposed to the revolt, but they were opposed because they said that Nazis and fascists were going to take over that revolt. And the young man who talked to me really believed it. We intervened in a civil war in Santo Domingo because we said that the communists were going to take over. Actually, my position on Santo Domingo is the position very well expressed by Senator Fulbright in a notable speech. I happen to have had rather close connection with some things in Santo Domingo, and so I know something that I'm talking about. We intervened at the very moment that built up again the military oligarchy, which was on the way to defeat. We intervened not to help Bosch and the constitutionalists, but apparently to help Imbert. Later we decided that Imbert, the government, was too bad, and we worked for a provisional government. The net result has been that everybody agrees, the only thing that everybody practically agrees on is that there are lots more communists now and in more influential positions in Santo Domingo than there were before, and the question is not solved. Incidentally, we've got lots of new enemies in Latin America.
I am taking a course in modern political theory. My professor says that he cannot define socialism. All you can do, he says, is state what socialism has meant at different times and places. Would you define socialism today?
Well, I'd say that your professor wasn't too far wrong. I would say the same thing's true if you try to define democracy. Same thing's true if you define Christianity. Same thing is true of most big words. Socialism does need continual re-examination in the light of the changing times. It does have this uniform quality, that it does believe there has to be comprehensive planning for the good of all, and that that planning has to be in terms which will change the way in which the results of our cooperative toil are divided. That, I think, is the uniform thing in socialism. This is the advertisement in the commercial. Your professor and anybody else is entitled to read my book, Socialism Reexamined, in which I give a whole chapter to this subject of definition.
Do you believe...
Let me say, it's rather funny. I was one time in a panel discussion on radio a good while ago, and one of my fellow panelists argued I was no socialist at all because I wasn't a good enough Marxist. And another panelist argued that everybody except herself, it was Vivian Kellams, was a socialist, because socialism began in America when William Howard Taft proclaimed the adoption of the income tax. You see, you're lost in a jungle. Go ahead.
Do you believe that the economic theory of communism is more practical than that of capitalism?
In the countries where it's supplied, certainly. It wouldn't be where it is. Communism also is subject to modification. And I think the modifications of communist economic theory and practice in Russia will bring it to pass, probably after I'm dead a good while, will bring it to pass that economically there won't be so much difference as you think between us and Russia. We will have become more centralized, they more pluralistic. I don't say we'll be identical, but there'll be no economic reason we should be particularly mad at each other. We'll be like General Electric and Westinghouse. We'll be competitors with deals under the table. Now, I did not therefore say that communism would be just the same as ours. It will probably be less democratic for a long time to come.
So I have a question.
Communism is based in terms of democracy, not in terms of economics primarily.
I have a question here concerning the right of people to dissent when it involves violation of the law. Citizens under over 21 have the right to vote for these laws. Therefore, should they not abide by their own decisions as a democracy?
In general, yes. I do not believe in civil disobedience as a virtue. If I did, I'd have to extol most of you who drive automobiles. I haven't noticed too much obedience. And there are certain other matters of that sort. No, I don't believe in civil liberties as civil disobedience per se, but I think there are times when civil disobedience, rather than violent conflict, is justifiable for the ends that are sought. For instance, it's the fashion of a lot of you people to manage to admire Thoreau, isn't it? Well, Thoreau refused to pay a tax for the Mexican War and went briefly to jail. Emerson paid the tax, if memory serves me. I personally would have paid it because, for reasons I won't go into. But I think Thoreau was not too far wrong morally when he did what he did. Civil disobedience would have been a terrific virtue in Germany if practiced by a great many people against Hitler's orders. And even Hitler had an immense electoral majority supporting him, if you happen to remember. I therefore think that the question of civil disobedience depends upon the magnitude of the issue, the relation of the disobedience to the change that's wanted, and the motivation of the person who practices. I do not believe there's either an absolute yes or an absolute no to be asserted in terms of civil disobedience. Incidentally, a lot of what gets called civil disobedience is really not quite civil disobedience. If you challenge a local law because you think it's unconstitutional, that's not civil disobedience. That's an appeal to an higher authority in the state.
What do you say when people argue that socialism or communism is against human nature?
Well, if it's so much against human nature, why do we spend so much money trying to lick them in China and elsewhere? Almost everything is against some trait in human nature. A lot of us would like to be anarchists. No government, no anything, and we know we can't be that way. There is no form of government possible that is strictly in accord with our curious and somewhat irrational human nature. All you can say is that quite obviously neither socialism nor communism is against human nature, or it wouldn't have been as successful as both of them are in certain places. I should say that the kind of capitalism of the 19th century was much more obviously against human nature in the way it rewarded men for little labor and the way it punished men who had to live simply by labor.
Would you advocate General Motors being socialized?
Well, I wouldn't begin with it. I might come to it. General Motors is, as far as you and me, you and I are concerned, it's socialized already. That is to say, it's under no set of controls by Adam Smith type of competition. How many of you know that Adam Smith, the great founder of the theory of competition as the universal regulator, Adam Smith opposed all corporations. He wouldn't allow for anything more than a partnership. He'd be shocked by General Motors, just as shocked as he would be by Sweden, for instance, which is socialist.
What would you suggest or recommend in case Red China, with its enormous numbers, became openly and obviously aggressive?
Well, I don't know. I myself well enough. It depends on what the aggression was and what the circumstances were. I wouldn't let China just come and run all over us, and I don't think there's the slightest likelihood that it'll happen anyway with any foreseeable future. And this is the kind of question that I want to politely to protest. It is a legitimate question, but nearly always it implies a skipping over of the immediate problem. The immediate problem is, given a dangerous country like China, in which nevertheless communism has done a pretty good job so far as the average man is concerned, that testimony is pretty clear. A country where communism is well established, a country so numerous, where the people are as able as they are, how are you going to get along with it? Aren't you going to try in safety to negotiate for inclusion in the family of nations, hoping that time, as time is doing in Russia, will moderate the extremes of the Chinese communism, hoping that the desire to live will bring them to a more reasonable point of view, hoping that their failure, and they are having some failures, in advancing their particular type of communism in Africa, people are getting scared of it, will have its effect. Oughtn't we to try that? Here you are in a church, and nowhere do I get more questions that imply that there's nothing in Christianity that can be applied to foreign relations than I do in church meetings. Apparently it's only for private use.
Mr. Thomas, there are a great many people who would doubt that you were in a church.
Well, all I can say is it looks like one.
Thank you for that.
A very nice one, I may say. And by the way, since I've been critical, I want to say that I have more hope than I used for the church, because the way it's great improvement in the matter of civil rights.
I have a question here relevant to this I was going to get to, and you might just as well go on. What do you think of Christianity?
Oh, no. All right. Again, one thing, I don't want to start Unitarians fighting, because some Unitarians say they're Christians and some say they aren't, so I don't want to get into trouble. Go ahead.
I'll give you an easier one. What do you think of President Johnson?
Well, I'm not a Washington columnist, and I'm not a psychiatrist, so I have a sort of humble layman's point of view. I think he's one of the ablest men that we've had in the White House. He has surprised me by the length to which he went in support of civil rights. He has done an extraordinary job in bringing to fruition the work of years that other people have done in the fields of social legislation. And he's dangerously wrong on his foreign policy. His private character I leave to people who know him better.
With a view to understanding better your approach to pacifism or to war, what was your approach to Mr. Hitler prior to 1939?
Well, that's an interesting question, which I've answered pretty much in a couple of my books. I'm not advertising them, some of them are out of print, but I'm not going to give you an autobiography at any length. But briefly, my position was this. I was a Presbyterian minister who became convinced that capitalism wasn't solving the desperate poverty of the people among whom I worked in East Harlem, and that war and Christianity were incompatible. I therefore, in the First World War, was both a socialist objector to our entrance into war, and I think my political grounds were fully confirmed by the results. I was an objector to our entrance into the First World War on political grounds, and also I was an objector on Christian pacifist grounds. As the years went on, somewhat to my sorrow, my theology somewhat changed, the theology that supported Christian pacifism. And reluctantly, I abandoned that, still hating war very much, but believing that in the kind of world we live in, it might be true that sometimes there's a war that was better than any alternative to it. I hated it because I thought war was so bad in itself and in its aftermath. What a legacy of violence it's left us, for instance. Believing this, feeling as I did, and for other reasons that I haven't time, my dissatisfaction with things in Russia and fascism and so on, I thought we ought to keep out of the Second World War. I wasn't an isolationist. I wanted to do lots of things, but short of war. We did get into war under circumstances where I thought there was no alternative practical to it, and I therefore gave critical support to the Second World War, working as hard as I could and organizing as hard as I could for a better peace. And I am, on the whole, prouder of what I said, and I think it was more, I did better predicting in 1944 than in any of my campaigns. I still keep this position. I would like to be an absolute pacifist, but I can't. I am, however, a great hater of war. I believe we've got to get rid of it, and I believe that the present war meets none of the conditions which present no desirable alternative, no better alternative. Do I make myself fairly clear?
What do you think is the proportion of influential factors in the draft card dissenters between those who have an honest objection to the use of war and those who are concerned for their personal safety?
Nobody can be absolutely sure. You can be sure if you know people, but you can't lay down any infallible truth. You can't lay down any infallible test of finding out all about people, can you? But you can reach a pretty good approximation. You've got the history of two world wars, and there were very few conscientious objectors, and most of those, I think, were very sincere. They took a pretty hard handling and bore up under it. I don't say that none of them were selfishly moved. Some people are selfishly moved when they join an army, especially under some of the conditions. Motivation's hard to judge. But I believe that in terms of philosophy, that it is a terrible kind of a world to live in where anything called the state has a right to take a man and say, you have got to kill on my orders, whatever you think about it yourself. And this is the kind of world we live in at present.
Now that civil rights legislation has progressed to where individual good faith is the chief bottleneck to implementation, how do you see this deficiency being resolved?
I lost some of that. Where's the bottleneck? There are lots of them, but which one is this one?
In individual good faith, you were making the point that it wasn't governmental legislation, it was a matter of the people stopping the progression of civil rights.
Oh, in civil rights?
Yes.
Well, I don't know that I quite follow the question. It seems to me quite clear. You can treat your colored neighbors as you would treat any neighbors, and on the same grounds. That's a rather simple rule. You can be desperately concerned that the civil rights laws we have are enforced. You can be interested to see that there isn't a real estate embargo against the right of colored people to live where they choose and where they behave themselves as other people would have them behave. You can do all those things. And I don't think it's hard to find a test. And you can vote for men who intend to give an honest enforcement to the law, not to twist it.
Do you find the student movements today on the level of being unpatriotic?
No, I do not. unless you define patriotism as absolute obedience to anybody who happens to be president of the United States in regard to conscience. I think the most patriotic thing a man can do who believes that war or a particular war is wrong is to say so, and to say so now. You would, I repeat that you all hold that view in Germany. You say that the great failure of the Germans was just to obey Hitler. The worst criminals in Germany said all they did was to obey Hitler. And Hitler was the elected leader of the state. They did it out of patriotism. Now, I again repeat that I don't want you to go out and say that Thomas compared Johnson to Hitler. I did nothing of the sort. I said that philosophically the issue was similar. And it is not patriotism to oppose what you think is wrong when your country does it, especially if you offer an alternative of negotiation or something else. It's the highest form of patriotism. And incidentally, you needn't be so scared. We are so made that the pressures, such as now being called forth, are terribly strong. At the present time, there are thousands of people, and I speak from experience, who a while back were very doubtful whether we had any business being in Vietnam at all, who now are saying, well, it's the country, and when the country speaks, and all the rest of it. And in saying it, they say that the people who still stick to their original position, that they're doing the country their service by arguing for justice, ought to go to jail or shut up.
You passed this question by, but I've had three or four others, so I'm going to present it to you in a slightly different form, reminding you that you are in a very religious community, and so this is an issue of much importance locally. What is the socialist view toward the church?
The American socialist view, the view of the party to which I belong, has been by formal declaration ever since 1908 or 12, along there, an insistence on the freedom of church and state, that it was not the business of the state what church, if any man belonged to. We are thoroughly committed and have been committed to that principle almost from our beginnings in America. Do I make that clear?
Yes, sir.
In other words, separation of church and state. I was nominated for high office governor of New York by the socialists at the time when I was still a Protestant clergyman.
What is the name of...
Let me say another thing. In a gloomy world, or some parts of it gloomy, I rejoice greatly at what's happening in the church, especially in the Catholic Church. It gives me new hope. The Catholic Declaration on the Liberty of Individual Conscience is a long, long step forward. The Catholic attitude on birth control and on divorce is turning very much for the better. It's now no uncommon thing for us in our organizations as well as in our meetings to have Catholic priests and nuns and very valuable members. I want to give this testimony of hope in the development I see, especially in the Catholic Church. Most of these developments had already taken place in the Protestant Church, but the Protestant Church in the field of civil rights is certainly doing better than before.
How does your Socialist Party differ from the Socialist Labor Party?
Socialist Labor Party wants to win an election so as to destroy the state and turn over the necessary functions of the state to one big union, which will by some miracle be a big Marxist union along their lines of interpretation of Marxism. I think it's a very undesirable alternative that they present, and wholly unlikely to be achieved. It would make for a dictatorship, inevitably. They would deny it, but I have never been in the least convinced by their denials. Their constructive program, I think, has little or no merit. Their critical program is often very astute.
Do you consider the increased, improved relationship between Russia and the United States as due to an enlightened common concern or as a result of power politics?
Oh, enlightened common concern. Once in a while, power politics makes sense if the power leads you to do something sensible. And I don't think that's a very well stated alternative. I believe that the improvement of relations between the United States and Russia is one of the hopeful things on the horizon, much impaired by the continuance of the war in Vietnam.
I say this not because I like everything that has been done in Russia, but because I think Russia shows the possibility of evolution without violence inside once Stalin was deposed.
In view of the fact that the Democratic Party has done so many socialistic things, are you willing to dissolve your party in favor of the Democrats?
No. What I want to do is to keep my party, our party, at least as an educational agency. There's an awful lot of educational work to be done. We work hard on our platforms and on advancing them, and we work hard on conferences. I want to keep my party well enough organized so that it may perhaps nominate congressmen when the Republicans and Democrats are Tweedledee or Tweedledum. Under present conditions, I do not think it wise to nominate a candidate for president. I say this sadly. So great is the cost of running any kind of campaign, much greater even than when I ceased running in 48. So fixed is labor in opposition to this policy. So I think that socialists ought to say we're socialists, but we're not concealing it. We're not trying to borrow from within, but we'll vote according to our conscience, Republican or Democrat, which in our part of the country means Democrat most of the time, and then say they ought to be better.
Mr. Thomas,
this may not be true 10 years from now, but this is my present. It would take a long time and much examination and much evidence to tell you all the reasons for it.
Would you say a word about the validity and the importance of the American Civil Liberties Union?
I think it's very few organizations have accomplished more as non-governmental, non-political organizations than the American Civil Liberties Union. I don't by any means say that it's wholly responsible for the general improvement in the condition of civil liberties and also civil rights. I say that it was a voice in the wilderness, especially right after the First World War, and that it has got increasing support. That it has kept its way, standing for civil liberties without involving itself in purely partisan politics quite admirably. That I support it, except that I think it ought to be more outspoken on the philosophy of conscription, concerning which I've spoken.
A week from tomorrow night in this church, there will be a forum to study in depth the problems of Red China. We are bringing some world-famous experts in this area. They have not been easy to find. You are very cordially invited to participate in that. And if you wish to do so, you may pick up a ticket on the way out or in the hall or any time during the week.
May I say how glad I am to hear that? One of the encouraging things where we need encouragement is this, that rather spontaneously out of the National Student Assembly, although it doesn't control it, arose a committee of students very much concerned for a re-examination of our whole Far Eastern policy with regard to the war in Vietnam, with regard to China. On short notice, they staged meetings in 25 or 30 campuses across the campus, served by telephone and master tape. They got experts on China and other subjects. It was a very fine job. You simply got to look into China. Not in terms of what you wish had happened, not in terms of your dislikes, there are things to dislike, but in terms of the existence of so powerful a people, growing steadily in power, who must be lived with somehow, and whom we have steadily insulted by insisting that they're represented by Chang, who's ingloriously driven out, and otherwise.
More than 35 years ago, Norman Thomas ran for mayor of New York City against Jimmy Walker and Fiorello LaGuardia. He was a candidate for president 6 different times. I am speaking just a personal word now because you have listened to this remarkable man all evening. He's probably the oldest person in the building tonight. He is legally blind, crippled with arthritis. Last week he spoke at 4 different colleges. Between January and June, he visited, besides groups like this, over 25 universities. He will speak at 3 next week, including one on the far west coast. I said when I introduced him to the congregation on several Sundays, verbally, that I wanted all our young people to come and hear this man. They would regret it if they did not, and it would be one of the great occasions of their life. Surely it must be a great occasion for we who consider ourselves middle-aged to note that this man, at this point, will travel around the country in behalf of opinions which he thinks are important to his people. And I believe they are. Would you express our common gratitude?
May I say a word? Yes. That very nice statement by the chairman leads me to a reminiscence. I ran twice for mayor of New York. We had the first program for public housing in New York, we socialists. It was weak compared to the present. Both the Democrat and Republican labor candidates, Mr. Beam and Mr. Lindsay, advanced as broad a program of municipal socialism as any socialist could have advanced. The only thing more would have required action by state and federal government. You can imagine how I felt hearing them talk in the names of Republicans and Democrats, a line of socialism which it was hardly listened to a few years ago. They don't call it socialism, by the way. But I am telling you the truth. No municipals, no man concentrating on municipal issues in the confines of the power of a municipal government could have advocated more than both Lindsay and Beam did. They still haven't told us how they'd pay for it.
Thank you all, and good night.